Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the CollectingCast.com podcast with Chris Harris and Edward Lovett.
Hello and welcome to another Collecting Cars podcast. Christmas special this time, and two of my favourite people we've yet to feature, the Franchitti brothers, a literal motor racing dynasty from up over the border. And hopefully we'll have a good chinwag with both of them now because they've got great stories to tell. So to Dario and Marino Franchitti, welcome to the Collecting Cars podcast. It should have happened sooner. And my dog, who is sitting down in the footwell of the Bentley Mulsanne, has just let a massive flabby woof woof go. So I'm gagging on the smell of dog fart as I introduce this.
That's somehow appropriate, God, isn't it?
Well done, Pip.
Oh, my Lord, it smells like a sewer in here. Right, so we're recording this on the 22nd of December. And there's a couple of glum-looking Scots people there who I presume have had their Christmas plans completely scuppered. Dario.
Hi.
So what were you supposed to be doing and what are you going to do?
Well, several months ago, we were supposed to be having a Christmas party. It was organised this time last year. That got obviously hit on the head quite a while ago. And then we were supposed to go to Switzerland for a bit of skiing because my wife can work from anywhere, I can work from anywhere. And we decided, let's go to Switzerland. But, of course, that's not happening. So I'm now stuck at home, but the good news is my new sim got delivered today, so life's about balance, isn't it?
Now, Marino, I know that you love your brother dearly, he's your best friend in the world, but how do you feel about him getting a simulator?
I'm bored, generally. He starts talking about it, him and Soper, we go out for dinner, and him and Soper start talking about sims, and the rest of us just go,
told you he'd do that.
Yeah, I do like playing on it when I go around, though. I do like having a wee go when I go around.
I think it's a good place to start. I think the virtual racing world was offered an opportunity during the first lockdown to really assert itself, and I personally feel it missed the opportunity. I think there was a few things went on that rather sullied the name of it. I'm not anti it. I'm just not into it. So I can see why other people are into it. I'm not. But how do you feel the virtual racing world came out of the lockdown situations, given they looked like they were going to take over?
Let the man who actually did it speak about this, because I had no involvement with it.
Yeah, apart from talking, when it was happening, Marino was in our bubble and he'd be sitting through in one of the rooms drinking wine. And I'd come through all sort of sweaty and knackered after crashing yet again. And I'd start talking about it. He goes, I don't want to know. I've got no interest in hearing about it. Can we change the subject?
I've already had to watch it. I at least watched it. I mean,
I think more people were exposed to it, put it that way. And I think there's a whole bunch of people that take it very seriously and are very good at it. I think the hard thing for us that have raced is that maybe we don't take it as seriously as we possibly should, as the other people do. So I think that did it a disservice, because there's some, you can have some good racing on there. Does it replicate what happens on the racetrack? No, because the danger factor is completely gone. And I think that gives some of the moves that happen, I think that's maybe why those moves happen. But I think more people were exposed to it, and it was entertainment. It definitely, you know, Formula E, we did this whole thing with it, all the whole field race, and we would commentate on it, and it was all set up. That, and then I did that Racing Legends thing, which they gave me, they sent me this the other day.
Pretty cool.
Grab them.
Oh, yeah, okay.
In the colours, and we did that for everybody that raced there.
And don't forget the beer. The beer was even better than the model.
The beer was awesome, yeah, because one of the sponsors was a beer company. So, yeah, it was... I enjoyed it. So
this links back into the first, let's say, career-based question. Dario, you raced in very high-consequence formula. You know, you were someone who put your body on the line. You had some enormous accidents in amongst your huge successes. You broke your back, ended your career effectively. So you know what it's like to make a decision on a racing track that could potentially alter your ability to walk. So how does that make you feel when you're sim racing and you're watching kids just stick out the inside and think they're really racing when they must be doing it without consequence?
Yeah, that's the thing. The lack of consequence changes it. And I'm sure if you look at some drivers from generations ago, when they watch today's drivers and with the sort of the somewhat lack of consequence, I'm sure they feel the same thing. Obviously, as you said, IndyCar is probably a bit more high consequence than other formulas, but Formula One certainly proved that you can still, you know, have some serious consequences with Romain Grosjean's crash. And I think that was a timely reminder that no matter how much runoff area, it's amazing that places you can put a racing car and you can make the circuits as safe as you possibly think you can. But, you know, a driver will do something and it'll put the car in a position you never thought.
Right. I think we're not going to get Marino into this conversation. If we carry on with Sims, it might be the best opportunity ever to keep Marino quiet. He normally isn't, but actually we'll move this back. Right. So for people that don't, there are some people that don't know the Franchitti story. How did you two get into motorsport? How did you get into cars? Where did it all begin? Give us where it started. I want the two Franchitti brothers, dashing, beautiful children with the world at their feet in Scotland in the mid-80s. How did it start? Come on, tell me about it.
He's 5 years older than me, so let him start.
I'm going to do the talking here, which is very unusual.
Work for me.
So when I was... I'd have been five, right about when Marino showed up, with 5 year age difference.
And his life was ruined.
My life was ruined, yeah. I started to become aware of Formula One. I'd sit and watch it with my dad. Our dad raced. Hang on, here's things falling out. Our dad raced for fun. It was his hobby, raced Formula Ford. And then late 80s, he bought a March Formula 2 car, raced around Ingolstadt with that. And so that was where my interest was sort of peaked. And actually, if you can see there, that's a row of these cars that our grandmother used to buy me when she'd go to Italy. And I found them recently on an auction website. But that's where it all started for me. I had motorbikes. I started racing cars, karts in 1984. And Marino sort of came along behind me. And he got the cast-offs, quite honestly. You know, because I was the older son. I got all the new stuff, and when Marino came along to start racing, he unfortunately, he got my cast offs and never got the attention that I did. So when he went and started his racing career, whether it was in karts or in cars or later, he completely did his own thing, got his head down, and did it all on his own.
I think with motorbikes, I remember, just to get back, I got a PB50 when I think it was 3 or 4. So it's funny, even now, as dangerous as they are, I feel more natural even on a bike than I do. I'm not very good, but I still feel very comfortable on a bike because that's how it started. But with racing, I think when I got into it, Dario took it really serious for me. So he he really put the pressure on, and that I found that took a bit of the sort of fun away from it early on.
Sorry, son.
No, that's all right.
But when did you both think it was going to become a career? When did you? I mean, Dario, did you ever think you'd do anything else? Marina, I've known you longer and know you better personally because I know what you've been through. But and there were times when it was obvious it wasn't going to be the only thing you could do because you needed to do something else to make some bunts. But with Dario, was it always your only career?
I went through a stage. Well, as a kid, you always think, you know, you can be an astronaut or you can be whatever you want when you're sort of 8-10 years old. And then, you know, I started racing, winning in karts. I thought, this is what I'm going to do. And as I became a teenager, the realities of racing and life and sport and the financial realities took over. And I thought, this might not happen. And it ultimately came down to mum and dad being mad enough to remortgage their house for my first year in racing, which then allowed, when I was racing, Jackie Stewart saw me and he then took me under his wing, brought all the sponsors, and that started it. So when I started racing for Jackie, that was probably the first time I thought it might actually work out. But I had a couple of jobs, did the sort of the racing school thing. I worked at Jim Russell, worked for some manufacturers. And I drove a two-car transporter as well, which was, I used to deliver cars, which was, it was really bizarre because I'd be driving this 814 Mercedes down the M6. I had a blowout one morning and I had to change the tire on the hard shoulder of the M6. And I was literally dressed in my Paul Stewart Racing team gear which we were sponsored by Boss at the time, because I was going to meet King Hussein of Jordan at Paul Stewart Racing, but I was driving a transporter down the M6. So my life was a little kind of weird. So I parked the truck around the corner from Paul Stewart Racing, ran in, had a good old wash, got rid of the dirt from changing the tyre, and went and met King Hussein. So life had its odd moments.
So the single-seater career from the start was pretty stellar. And then you were one of the first people to, it seems to me, you know, I was an Autosport reader back then, and your name was there, and there was this assumption you were just going to walk into F1. And then when you didn't, it seems to me you were the first person to pragmatically say, I'm not going to bash my head against this door and make myself bitter and twisted. I'm going to go to America and make my fortune, which is exactly what you did. But you were the first person to have the bollocks to do that and not to be the bitter one that hung around the paddock trying to make it work. Is that a fair assessment of how you felt about it at the time?
So Marino was really involved in this sort of this time because I'd been living in Milton Keynes. Marino was still up at school in Scotland. And I got a call from Mercedes, and I went to test the DTM car. And that's where the sort of the divergence from, I guess, the F1 path happened. And it, with DTM, it came down to I was racing for Paul Stewart Racing. But I wasn't comfortable on the team. 1 year, Formula 3, I wasn't comfortable on the team. Mercedes said, look, if you come and drive for us, we'll pay you this amount of money. And trust me, this was a fortune for me. And we're going to give you a C36 company car. And I remember standing with Jan Magnussen in the car park because we were both being considered for this drive. And I said, will you do it, Jan? And he said, if you give me one of those company cars, I will. And that was it. And so I went there and I drove for Mercedes for a couple of years, and I got to test for McLaren. And that actually coincided when I left to go to America. Then McLaren came and said, oh, would you come and be test driver? But it wasn't going to work with what I'd done in America. And the American thing came down to Mercedes helping me get there. There's a guy, Paul Morgan, who was one of the partners in Ilmor. I sat next to him at the Christmas party at Mercedes in 1996. And he said to me, what do you want to do? And I'd had those two cracking years in DTM, so much fun. With those crazy cars with all the bits on them. And I said, I want to go to America. And he sort of looked at me and he said, well, I'll see what I can do. And literally a month later, the phone rang and he organized it. and off I went to the American adventure. Had a couple of chances to come back and test F1 cars with the chance of racing them, but it just never, I had a horrible test for Jaguar, and then just, it was never the right time. So I stayed in America and had a good time.
Remember that first C36? Because it was, he had Klaus Ludwig's old company car, because he basically took Klaus's seat. And the first one, Klaus had been wrapping it around the Nürburgring, but it had all these special bits on it. It was the fastest thing on four wheels.
That was so fast, wasn't it? There's a picture somewhere of I had the old camera, like an old style, I think 35mm camera, and I'm battering down the Autobahn and the it's off the clock. Remember I had those big sort of dials in the middle, and it's right off the clock, all the way around to the bottom of the dash, basically, and I'm click and somewhere there's this picture.
I love the DTM stuff is fascinating, because you were in that era when they weren't far off F1 cars in terms of the tech they were deploying. They were as far away from being a saloon car as you could imagine. And you arrived, and Bernd Schneider, he speaks still with wide eyes about it. When you bring him onto that subject, that era, he goes, well, this, I was the man, and then this bloody kid from Scotland turned up and basically stuck it to me. I think what makes Bernd so great is that he loved the challenge you brought to him. Clearly, he didn't resent it. He just loved the fact he had to try and up his game to try and beat you. But there's some mega footage of, and also, where's that race where I think you just duffed up someone in an alpha? It might have been
Suzuka.
And the alpha pit wall are about that close from jumping onto the track to lob stuff at you.
It was a really, really quiet press conference with Christian Danner and I that day. Because it was
Christmas dinner.
He wasn't happy. And We were delighted, but Schneider was the best teammate, man. That was the thing. I went there as a 21-year-old kid, and German team. I didn't speak German, and a guy called Gerhard Unger was running the whole thing. And
so
for some reason,
why did they choose a Scottish kid? I mean, obviously your talent must have been precocious, because they must have had a full lineup of baby Schumachers that could have gone in. It's a hell of a punt taking a lad that didn't even speak the language.
Yeah, we went and did a test. We, being Jan Magnussen and I, went and did this test. Oliver Gavin did the test too. And Jan and I both broke lap record. And so they went on him and we want him. And and Bernd, for some reason, Bernd and Gerhard just took me under the wing. And Marino's at some of the races. They just, for some reason, it all just clicked. And Bernd was the best teammate. I mean, he was this god, and he was just mega. We had so much fun. I remember staying at his house one day in Cologne, and I get this bang on the door because I'd like to sleep in. Okay, come on, we're going to do something fun. Oh god, we're going to go running again. I don't want to go running again. And so he says, no, get dressed. We're going to see something fun. Okay, this could be anything. So we go around the corner, we walk around the corner, and we go to this big house. And the two doors go up, and there's two Bugatti EB110s and an F40 LM sitting. And he said, okay, come on, we're going to take these Bugattis for service. My friend owns them, and I know you want to drive one. So we took these two Bugattis from Cologne up to Brabus, I think it was. And it was the first time I broke 200 miles an hour, chasing him down the Autobahn in this Bugatti EB110. So that was the kind of stuff that that happened when Mr. Schneider was around.
The first time I met Marino was at the Nürburgring in probably around 07. And so I'd barely spoken to him he was in Tim Parker Racing in a cup car. We were both racing cup cars in either a 24-hour race or a VLN. I think it was 24-hour race. And I'll let him jump in a minute. Anyhow. And we sort of exchanged pleasantries in the racetrack. And I thought, what a nice guy. Actually, I don't normally think what a nice guy. I normally just think knob when I meet people, because I'm that, as you know, I'm that kind of miserable bastard. But I thought, what a nice bloke. Because what struck me about him was he was interested in road cars. I've got a bit of thing about racing drivers that don't like normal cars. And both of you, I know, will come onto it, love good performance cars. But a lot of racing drivers aren't interested in road cars. And I always think that's a little bit disingenuous. So we had a very quick chat about some Porsche business. And then the next time I saw Moreno after that, I came over a section of the track called Flugplatz. And it looked like a small passenger aircraft had attempted to land on the circuit, got it wrong, and then crashed down that part of the track. I'd never seen a crash like it at the Nürburgring. I still haven't, actually. And at the end of all this debris, there was the crumpled shell of what... You couldn't even tell it was a Porsche. It was just... Excuse the French. It was fucked. But there was no body in it. And then as I was coming over the crest, the team radio came on and said, oh, be careful. Marino's just had a massive stack over that part of the track. And I saw him later on, and he was completely unperturbed, really. And I thought, that's the difference between a real racing driver and a journalist like me. He was just getting ready, prepared to go and drive the next racing car. Mate, that was, we've never discussed it publicly, that was an amazing smack. And I don't think you should necessarily be here after that one. It was massive.
If it hadn't been a Porsche, I don't think I would have been. It was a 996 Cup car. And I'll never forget, I came over, and as it landed, it just went left. I had no idea what happened. Wheels were straight, all the stuff you do. And it turned out that the left-hand drive shaft had snapped. So it just turned it hard left. And I remember the first impact, having my eyes open and the doors flew off. The windscreen came out and the left front came up through the windscreen. So at that point, I closed my eyes. And then I remember feeling the hands device holding my head. And then it was just like, oh, that was an impact. And I'm thinking, oh my, every time I thought it's over, it kept going and going and going. And when I came to a stop, there's just nothing, as you say, nothing left. And I do remember sitting, just having climbed out and looking down the track and seeing you coming over in the 997. And oh my God, it was huge. But you're right. It was like they made me go to hospital and then get back. And there was a message from, I was driving with Andretti Green in America and the Acura Ireland P2. And they're like, oh, we need you to come for a test in 2 days. I'm like, oof, this is going to suck. But because of the safety equipment, I didn't hurt. It was unbelievable. I think I dissipated all the energy as I went on.
So we never really discussed this. How do you become a racing driver in the shadow of your big brother who's already doing a fantastic job? Seems to me that you went about it with an enormous amount of good grace and huge energy. And you know, you achieved amazing things. You won Sebring, dude. I mean, that's an amazing thing. I'd kill to bloody win Sebring. So, but it can't have been easy. It must have been tough.
It had its good points and its bad points. I think it opens a lot of doors. Like 2 weeks before DTM was cancelled, I met, who was the boss alpha at that point, Dario?
Giorgio Pianta.
So I meet Giorgio Pianta at Silverstone in the summer. Lawrence Foster from Autosport says, hey, this is Dario's little brother, Marino. He's like, do you race? And I'm like, I was racing tested a 1600 Formula 4 at the time, tested one car. George's like, come and drive our DTM car. I'd love to see what you can do. Okay. Next thing, email or a fax. I think a fax comes from him. Come to Mugello. I'm like, Daddy, what's Mugello like? He's like, oh, for fuck's sake, you're going to kill yourself. And then fortunately for all involved, the championship was completely cancelled 2 weeks before the test happened.
I'd forgotten about that.
Oh, man, that was mega. And I just took every opportunity I could get. You know, I worked at Knockhill at the race school. They were really good, giving me a place to work at the race school. On the weekends that the race school wasn't on and there was races, you would empty the toilets clean the toilets and empty the bins. And then I remember Dario.
You got it the right around when you were working there. Otherwise you wouldn't have lasted long.
Yeah, exactly. I tell you, whatever your job is, you do it properly. You do the best job you can. And then I got glandular fever and I was ill for a while. And I hadn't really done much karting. But I got this deal together to do the winter series. I remember Dario saying to me, he's like, right, here's what the budget is. He says, I'll give you 50%. I'll match every pound that you can get. And he obviously thought I'd get about 500 quid. So I then went and found half the budget and he had to stump for half the budget. So that was fun.
Look at that big brother face.
And then it was really around this time that I met Kay Wilson, who had been the team coordinator at Porsche, at the factory Porsche team, and worked with some amazing drivers. And she took me under her wing, managed me, and got me just some really cool opportunities. And I stumbled through 2 years of single seaters with not very good equipment. And to be honest, probably not the right attitude either, because everyone expected, because I was Dario's brother, to be this complete driver. And because I'd been around tracks my whole life, I expected, because I'd been around it, that I'd somehow learned something or had experience. And it wasn't until I sort of sat down with myself and thought, well, hang on, what should you know? Nothing, because you've not done anything. And that was when, you know, I started to get some success. But that was also, I was driving really bad equipment. So the first time I got decent equipment was I tested a Porsche, a British GT Porsche 996R at the time, GTR, and then, or GT3R, yeah. And then the next year, Porsche Cars Great Britain had a junior program. They chose me as one of the drivers. And that was the big step. That was, I then had good equipment, and straight away I had speed, just because I'd been so used to trying to get everything out of bad equipment. And that was really where it started. Oh yeah, well, yeah, I had a Boxster as well. 21, I went from a 405 turbo diesel, and I lived near Bedford, and it was the same color as all the taxis, so everyone thought it was a taxi, to a brand new Boxster. And like my Dario always taught me, like, if you ever get the chance to be paid, you take it, whatever it is, because then you're a professional. And that's what I did. So it was, there was a lot of ups and downs. The thing for me is it never seemed to get, even when I had the success, it never took off from there.
Do you remember that first time at Daytona?
Yeah, it was good.
When you went, what year was that? We went to Daytona and Marino had never been there. 2002, never been there, jumped in the car and the test aim was quickest of anybody. And I was like strutting about, like, thinking, how, that's my wee brother.
Yeah, it was 2 seconds up the road and they got within half a second. But this was the ridiculous thing at the time. I'll never forget, we're in Nashville at Dario's house, me, him and my cousin Michele. And I'm like, I've got this chance at Daytona, so I'm going to go. He's like, all right, when is it? And I told him, Desti. He's like, I'll come with you. So then at the time, Dario's Billy Big Bananas and he rents this little Learjet. So I fly into Daytona without a pot to piss in a Learjet, do the test, do 5 laps in the car. That's all I get, fastest in the test, and then we leave. And it's like, it was the weirdest. It was the weirdest thing, but very funny.
So when did you've always loved street cars, haven't you, both of you? I think that's what appeal. You know, I love the fact that you both love street cars, and obviously Marino and I work on a. He does more than I do on a particular streetcar we'll discuss in a minute. But so, Dario, when did you drop your first serious paycheck on a motor car? And what was it?
The day after he got it.
That's the wrong way to do it.
It depends what you mean by serious. Are we talking? So the first, I won the Young Driver of the Year in 1992, McLaren Autosport Young Driver of the Year. And I might have used some of that money to buy a Mark II 16-valve Golf.
Yes!
Which was, my dad bought it at an auction. And a set of lower-end springs and a set of 15-inch wheels.
And removing the white steering wheel.
And removing the white leather steering wheel was... it was a mega thing, and it went like the wind, and I loved that wee car, and I lived in Bedford at the time. I lived in a place called Harold, and it got nicked. So that was probably the first time I dropped, at that point it was serious cash. It was $2,500. And then
the serious cash, the measurement of that is a percentage of what you actually have in the bank. So if you're worth $1 billion and you buy a Chiron, that's not serious cash. But if you haven't got a pot to piss in, as Marino said, you drop 8/9 of what you've got on a car, that's a lot of money.
Aye, that was okay. In that case, that was serious cash. And then the next thing I bought was a 1995. I bought a 3.2 Speedster.
3.2 Speedster. Now that's an interesting car to buy, because that's not an obvious Cognoscenti car to buy, but actually they are cool as you know what. They're great, much better than the 964 Speedster as well.
Yeah, I had a 964 Speedster until recently, but I've got a model of it somewhere. I think it might be in Scotland. I've got a model of the 3.2 Speedster, and I loved it. And I drove it everywhere on the rev limiter. Everywhere. Flat out. As hard as it would go. Actually, our great friend Stuart has owned it since. He bought it from me in 1996 when I sold it to buy a 348.
Bro, if you're listening to this on an audio file, it's a Zoom call. Both Frankitti brothers have put their heads in their hands in shame and are looking at the ground.
What a shed. What a shed.
I love that story about when Montezemolo took over at Ferrari, and it was apparently one of his first days, whether this is apocryphal or not. And he had to go to the airport and he said, give us a car. So they gave him a 348. And he came back about 10 minutes later and said to an engineer, is this what we're selling people? and he went, yes. He said, well, we have to start again then, don't we? Because this is terrible.
What a lump of crap it was. Dreadful. And I got in trouble because I drove it to Silverstone DTM race instead of taking my Mercedes company car.
It was bright yellow.
It was bright yellow. And yeah, that Norbert Haug was not happy.
I'm not bloody surprised. He's spending a lot of money to promote his brand. You turned up in a Fiat.
Well, it didn't break down. That was one thing. On the one occasions.
So the streetcar thing has always resonated strongly with both of you. You've suddenly got, what happens when you, this is to Dario, come to Marino afterwards. What happens when you do realize that you've made it, that you've had a couple of years in DTM, you've gone to America and it's happening. It's really happening now. Like I can remember turning on an episode of some sitcom and there's Dario Franchitti on the freaking sitcom.
Suddenly Susan. What was it called? Suddenly Susan, him and Eric Idle.
Yeah. I mean, what you've become part of the vernacular then.
And also, he was really crap at playing himself.
I was terrible. It was awful. Yeah. Thanks, Mino.
Yeah, but hold on. I did the Chris Evans season of Top Gear, lads. We've all got something in our closet. There's skeletons everywhere, mate. So don't worry about it. So at that point, the life, you must be thinking, how have I come from this, fairly normal provincial life in Scotland to this? You know, I can hire a Learjet to take my brother to go and do 5 laps of Daytona.
Well, put it this way. There are times you lose perspective. And I think everybody goes through an arsehole stage when things like that happen to them. And I definitely went through an arsehole stage. But it was always, basically when I did well, I would reward myself with buying cars. So the first thing I did, I got my first big signing bonus. I stomped out and bought a 355, which I still have. Then I started winning some races. And I got a new contract, went out and bought an F40. And it kind of went from there. And then when I started winning, I kind of bought some stuff, and then it went a bit mad when I started winning Indy 500 and stuff, and it could really,
explain to the European viewers or listeners how the earnings, how it works over there, because it's quite different to in Formula One. You get a contract and that's what you get paid, isn't it? Basically, there might be some win bonuses and everything else, but there's prize money over there, isn't there? And the way the Indy 500 is so big on its own. Can you just describe how that? I'm not looking for disclose any sums. I'm just saying how does it work structurally?
Well, it's actually quite similar. F1's got not prize money, but it's got points money that they don't really talk about. They don't tell you what the amounts are. It's all quite opaque. But IndyCar, you get your salary, then you get win bonuses, you get prize money. But then, of course, the Indy 500 is the big fish. If you can win that, it's sort of, it's millions of dollars to win it. And that definitely winning that one allowed more car purchases. It was quite nice.
How many times did you win it?
3.
Ah, there we go. Just the 3 times. Yeah, so all this time, Marino, you're I presume you're over there. You're racing P2 anyway. Are you LMP 2 years or just before that?
It's kind of mixed in GTs and then into LMP cars. Yeah. It was interesting. You talk about when you think you've made it. I've never had that because every time I thought it was starting to pick up some momentum, it would stop dead. I never had that thought. But yeah, I was in and out there. So I lived in America for 1 year in 2005 in him and his ex-wife's guest house, which was tremendous. I didn't have, I was getting paid absolutely nothing, but I did have a lot of fun. Because he would be away all the time and it'd be like some really tasty things sitting in the garage. And he's like, you really need to keep them moving for me. I'm like, yeah, that's not a problem.
apart from that 996 Turbo S that I
messed up. Oh, God, yeah. Got Turbo S cab, which he then got these champion wheels and lowered it. And it was a, it just upset the car to the point it was a death trap.
Total
death trap. So, yeah, I was there and it was, they were good days. I mean, racing in America is, I love racing in America. I really feel like a fish out of water in Europe. I don't enjoy racing in Europe. I enjoy the historic stuff, but if you're talking professionally, America's just better. The competition is no easier. The tracks are, for me, better. Yeah. There's still some classics, obviously, in Europe, Spa, Nürburgring, Open Park, ones like that. But in America, they're all like that. And off the track, you're having more fun.
You know, can I tell the story, the Sebring story? The first,
which one?
The LMP yes, test.
Well, you're going to have to now.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that was good.
So I was driving for Andretti, Andretti Green at the time. I had a really crap 2006. In 2007, they're sort of, you say, oh, we can't do this. We can't afford to pay you that. But I was like, all right. So I did a sort of, I call it a prize money heavy deal. But I said, right, they had an LMP. They're going to drive, they had an Acura LMP2 program. I said, right, okay, I'll do a deal with you. I'll drive it two or three races, but I want my brother to drive it at the other races. You know, he's proved himself, you know what he can do. Give him a chance. And they went, yeah, okay. So Marino and I show up at the first test at Sebring, and Brian Herta, who had been my teammate in IndyCar and won, you know, won a few races in IndyCar, was going to be Marino's teammate. So they show up on the short course at Sebring, and the team are saying, okay, Marino, if you get within two, I think it was 2 seconds, if you get within 2 seconds of Brian today, we'll be really happy. Okay, so just 2 seconds, just play yourself in. And I think within 10 laps, he was a second up the road.
Get in there,
absolutely astounding. And then the first race at St. Pete, ended up leading the race, and that was against the Audis. The big diesel Audis as well. And he just clicked with that car.
Race. I remember footage from that race.
Yeah, those so cars, those cars are mighty. Those cars,
did you share? Did you share the car together?
No, we didn't.
Tested it together, but yeah, never raced it.
Yeah, I did Sebring and Long Beach. And then at the end of the year, 07, I left the team. I went to do NASCAR, and Marino had done a fabulous job in the car, but the team were upset with me for leaving. So Marino was collateral damage in that whole bloody thing. That was the end of it.
So Marino, at the moment, Marino and I are involved in this thing called the Singer DLS. Now, I'll touch on this for a bit. It came about because we've got a mutual friend called Mazen Farwaz who runs that project. And at the time, you'd just had this dalliance with the Ford GT program, which wasn't a happy ending for you, Marino, was it? Nope. You needed some gainful employment, and this seemed like the right thing to do. It definitely is the right thing to do. Tell me how you feel about that car when it's being driven quite quickly on the right road at the right time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It excites me. the thought of never of finishing up the tuning of it and then having shaken all the cars down and never driving it again makes me want to cry. I took Dario for a curry in it earlier in the year. And the first time I opened it up, all he said was, there's no way that's only 500 horsepower. It was brilliant. It's incredible. The engine, which we never thought would be such a big part of it, along with it being lightweight, that engine, I can even slide it about because it's so playful. It's ridiculous.
It's a funny beastie, isn't it? Because it just, combination of weighing nothing and having, it just feels so naughty above 7,500 RPM. It keeps going. Your ears are going, oh, should I be doing this? And then you look down and the numbers are horrendous. But it just feels so fast. It's just one of those cars that feels so fast.
It's also that independent front suspension. That first, you're in a short wheelbase, 964. And the first time you turn into a corner, your head just goes, sorry, what? Kind of your equilibrium gets a bit funny. Like you've gone off Eau Rouge for the first time. You're like, sorry, what just happened there? It's a spectacular car. I mean, COVID's been a total pain in the backside for the program, but next year, you know, we'll get the cars to the customers, and it's going to be mega.
How much? Dario, thoughts? Have you owned a Singer yet, Dario?
What color would you like?
Oh no! Come on.
Yeah.
Has he done it? Is he dropped?
Oh, I'm at carbon stage.
Oh no!
Well, Ed came round. Ed had his one, and I had a look at that, and I thought that's absolutely beautiful. But I want the full experience. I want the full thing. So, spoke to dear Maz and the boys at Singer, and yeah, and it's on. Well, it's not on its way yet, but although I do think they've sent me three samples of the same paint this week. I'm quite particular about
the Joe McCarry.
I think they've done the Joe McCarry trick of, yeah, here's option 1, 2, and 3. And I'm outside today looking at these options going, 1, 2, and 3 are the same. So I'm hoping for a mid, it depends what happens with all this nonsense, but I'm hoping for a mid-year delivery. Yeah. If I can ever make up my mind on final specs. It's the DLS, I think, is just a mighty thing. I think we're quite spoiled. I mean, I'm working with Gordon Murray on the T50, between the DLS, the T50, the, you know, for the right person, the Valkyrie, pretty cool. But this my Singer's, I call it dad spec. It's got sunroof, it's got rear seats for the kids. I've got the racing thingy seats though, so they're gonna have to climb over or get in the back because I draw the line somewhere.
That's all right. They do that in my 911. They quite like that. They pretend they're in the Dukes of Hazzard. So we need to touch on that now. The T50 thing with Gordon's really, really interesting and heartening for people like me that want to one day drive one, because I think you're a racing driver that has an understanding of how a road car should drive. And quite often when racing drivers are told to define road car dynamics, I get a bit scared because you just end up with a racing car on the road, which isn't always a very good thing. So you must be very excited to get involved with that.
I am. I'm massively excited to do it. It was it's one of those things I couldn't quite believe I was getting to do it, if that makes sense, because I think, you know, Gordon's he's one of my heroes, and he's just so cool. He's just so interesting to hang around with and ask questions. And every day it's a school day and you learn something. And he's got very clear ideas of what he wants from this car. And that's brilliant, because I think his baseline is pretty cool. You know, what he's done in the past. And so it's been brilliant to do what we've done so far. I can't wait to drive it. It's going to be phenomenal. And then to get involved in the actual intricacies of developing it, you know, something you guys have done with the DLS with Singer, and watching the level of detail Marino's gone into it every day with this car, I'm super excited about it, and can't wait to drive it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Ed.
Say that again, Edward.
Have they got the engine on the bench now for the T50?
The engine is on the bench, and George the mule has got the engine in the back too, and is doing all the boring stuff at the moment. That has to be done, you know, emissions and all that, you know, the calibrations and all the stuff that means when you're driving along with it, well, first of all, you can drive along with it in the road, and that it's just putting the small details. So it actually, you sit in traffic with it, and it doesn't. I mean, we've all driven those cars with the light switch throttle that every time you're stuck in London traffic or in an M25, you hate the person that did that. So it's got to be one of the things that Gordon's talking about, and it has to be that way. Is it has to be able to be used, and it has to be perfect in all, you know, all types of use. So that to me, it's I love taking a car on a, you know, whether it's the back roads of Scotland or up in the Alps or any of those places. So this is the perfect thing.
Well, if Marie, I remember seeing the day you get to drive it, you're welcome to take me for a curry that day.
Well, I remember seeing you two talking about road trips. I remember seeing you two rock up at Le Mans one year when I was down there doing some work, and you'd arrived in I think you had a red Carrera GT. And that looked like exactly the correct way to use that type of car. If you buy these things and you don't do that in them, what's the freaking point in owning them?
I'm so stuffed. It was so stuffed for crap, wasn't it, Marino? I've got pictures of the shoes down the back of the seats, underwear, you know, the little door pockets inside those, we had our underwear stashed and socks and those. We couldn't get another bit in there because we wanted the top off, wanted the roof off, and of course that takes up what little space is in the front. But I'm funny that I look under a car and it's all been either fresh restored or it's, you know, beautiful and new, and I really struggle to when they're in the wet and they get all dirty and that sort of stuff. So I do struggle with that. But you know, when the Carrera GT, coming back from that Le Mans trip, I got caught in a load of rain. I went to Reading for its annual, and I got the guys there to take all the floors off, everything out, and make sure that it was cleaned underneath to, you know, within an inch of its life. And that's what, like Rich Tipper with F40, like, Rich, can you do what you do? And of course he did what he did, and the car came back just better than new. So I'm getting more relaxed about using these things in the way they should be used.
Remember when we killed the 355?
Yes, we did.
So he was recovering from his first broken back, and we were at a Celtic were playing a European game, and we got back to his house in Scotland at Parkhead, and we got back to his house near Edinburgh near 1 in the morning. He's like, "What are you up to?" Like, "Not much. Do you want to go to Monaco and see McNish?" "Yeah, let's do that." So we jump in the 355. It's got straight through tubies at the time, and we pack it full of stuff. He's got a lovely velvet cushion off his sofa for his back because his back's broken. He's just out of a back brace.
That came from IKEA. From IKEA.
Yeah. So then we set off, and by the time we get to the Channel Tunnel, we want to shoot ourselves because the drone from the tubies, we've got toilet paper stuffed in our ears. And also the car had, we doubled the mileage on the car in a week, and the car hadn't been used much. The front dampers collapsed. So then the thing was, even in the motorway speed, was twitchy as hell. And we get down near Monaco, and we're like, right, let's truck it home. Because we were meant to be going up from there up to Germany to watch our little cousin in DTM. We're like, right, let's truck it back, sell it, something. And then we hit the tunnels at Nice, between Nice and Monaco, and gave it the big one. And this is brilliant. And then we nearly got arrested coming into Monaco, doing nothing. But they just obviously looked dodgy. And then we drove it up through the Alps, up the Stelvio, down the Stelvio Pass in the snow. And yeah, that was epic. It hurt our ears, but it was so good.
They're still beautiful cars as well, aren't they? Something about a 355. In fact, if someone says to me they don't like the way a 355 looks, I'm not sure I could be their friend.
No. It's just a great thing, isn't it? It's just a great, you know, that five-valve head, the noise it makes, it's fast enough to be interesting, but it's not so fast that it's, you know, you're constantly sort of worried about going to jail driving it. But you go back to 95, 96 when they first came out. Do you remember how fast they were?
Yeah.
You were like, this is a spaceship. This is, and now you kind of go, it's a nice little car.
Marino's just touched on it there. I have to ask you this. I don't know many people that have had broken their back twice. The anatomy of an accident in IndyCar. What Do you have that aura the moment it's going on, that everything slows down, you know something bad's going to happen to you? Or is it just a surprise and you come round and you think, oh, my back's not right? Talk us through it. I know it's macabre, but I want to know, because it's gladiatorial. Not many people have been through this shit.
So the first time I broke my back was on a motorbike. So that was a different thing. I had an MV Agusta Senna, and Marino and I were out playing, and the bike broke, and I went over, and that was it. All accidents are different. I mean, you guys know that, you've all had accidents, but the two of the big ones. I had one in Michigan when Dan Weldon and I touched wheels about, I don't know, 215 miles an hour or something, 220, and the car took off. And that was one thing, one type of accident, because it went on for a long time. And I remember, it's funny, watching the Grosjean thing last week, I had to switch it off, because I remember taking off and literally thinking, oh shit, this isn't good. And as it's taken off, I'm my foot's still flat, and I hear the thing hitting the limiter. It's like, because the wheels are off the ground now. And it's going up in the air. And I thought, oh no. And I thought, well, please don't hit the fence. Please, I knew if I hit the fence, I was in trouble. I was like, please don't hit the fence. Then I thought, I wonder if I'm gonna die. Oh, I don't really want to die. I hope it doesn't hurt. And it was all very quiet at this point. So I opened my eyes, and I was about 20 feet above the track with cars going underneath me. Oh God, then in my head, it's just, how much is this going to hurt when it stops? And what happened was I landed on top of Scott Dixon, whose helmet's that one there. Landed on top of Scott, and it was no harder than falling over on the grass playing football. And I started laughing. I'm like, oh, it didn't hurt. I can't believe it didn't hurt. The car was upside down at this point, and it's sliding along, and then the roll hoop snapped. So my head starts dragging, the helmet's dragging along the ground.
Oh.
And I was like, oh no, is this ever going to end? Anyway, it ended. They turned it over. I had a black eyes because the helmet had come down on my head. And that was it. That was all the damage. And then 6 days later, I had another flip. And so that, oh yeah, it was been an interesting time. But then the last accident happened so quickly. I lost 5 weeks of memory, but I don't remember anything about it.
The violence of that one was extraordinary. I mean, I think, you know, difficult for you guys to watch it as brothers, but just the violence of the car, the way it got whipped around off the fence was, just, I remember watching it thinking, well, how can a human body survive that kind of rapid acceleration, deceleration like that?
When I got to the workshop in Indy a week and a bit after that, at Chip Ganassi Racing, and they had the debris sitting there. They had the chassis was in the shop and be stripped off, and I couldn't believe it just used up every bit of safety that it had and more, which is amazing for an Indy car because they've got all these different crash structures in the front. And then next to it is a pile of parts. I'm like, where's the rest? They're like, that's it. And if you look at the accident, everything just turns to dust. And it's funny, he talks about the Grosjean accident. We were sitting together when he had the accident, and instantly I'm like, he's dead. There's just no... But actually, it was like PTSD. It was weird sitting in the room with Dario while it was happening, because it brought back all these feelings from when he would have those types of accidents, and that feeling that you don't know if he's alive or dead. That is fucking terrible.
It's interesting from a European perspective, people like myself, journalists that vaguely report on the sport. I'm not an F1 journalist, but I still, I suppose I comment on it on social media. We talk about the modern racing era as being so profoundly safe, but your era, Dario, of that sport will be remembered as being profoundly unsafe. A lot of people lost their lives. Do you think that was just part of the sport, or do you think it was, do you think there's negligence in the safety aspects, or how do you feel about it?
No, I don't think there was negligence. I think everybody that was in charge of safety at the time was doing as much as they possibly could. There was no sort of I wouldn't look and say, you know, Jackie could look at the 70s and say, you know, in the 60s and say, they didn't care. The people, the promoters, the safety, they didn't care. We didn't have that in IndyCar. Everybody cared a great deal. Has it moved on since then? Absolutely. Are the tracks inherently still dangerous? Yeah, well, not. Ovals are dangerous because of the speed you're traveling. But they've now got this aero screen that Red Bull Technologies developed with IndyCar, and it's kind of a halo within a sort of a fighter canopy around it. And it's moved the game on again. It's made things a lot safer. But racing's never going to be fully safe. And you know, that's in some ways part of the risk reward is part of the walking of the tightrope is part of that interest, isn't it? I never liked the danger, but if there was no, go back to the sim thing, if there's absolutely no jeopardy, then it's not nearly as rewarding when you get it right.
Marina, what do you think about it all?
I agree. I think that we can only, what I don't like is when people look back at different eras through the present, you know, present optics. So they try and, if people are doing their best at the time with the technology they have, their understanding of safety and everything else, that's all you can ask. You can't sort of look back. I think things like the halo, of course, we all miss that connection with the driver. But the moment they showed the halo, I thought about the friends that we have that have died and would still be here. And I'd put the halo on every single car I could if they were still with us. But it's always acceptable risk. And in racing, you know, I think we've known a lot of drivers, probably more than our fair share for this era, who have unfortunately passed away. And it's a risk you accept. And you always ask that question when the worst happens. Like at Le Mans in 2013, was it? When Simonson passed away.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember walking up to the pit wall. The place was, you just knew there was something wrong because tracks go really weird when someone's passed away. They just go quiet. And I walked up to the pit wall. I had my helmet. I was in second. I walked up with my helmet and I said to the engineer, "Is there any news?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm sorry, man. He's gone." And I'd been with him about an hour before the race. We'd run into each other outside our hospitalities. And we were talking about, my son at the time was, I think, about 3 months old. And he had a daughter that was a little bit older than that. We were talking about kids. So I then literally put my helmet on, hands device on. 60 seconds later, I'm in the car going down the Milsand Strait past where he died. And it sounds weird, but you accept that risk and you continue to do it. And one day, maybe that changes, but you accept it.
Let's add some Christmas cheer now. It's a fascinating subject, yeah, but it could be considered a little bit macabre. Right, so I've got a problem at the moment. I think there's some really good value. I've got a lot of problems. I've got a lot of problems just the way I look, my personality, my odor. There's a lot of shit going wrong with me. I don't smell as bad.
He's stuck in his arsehole stage as well.
Jesus, I've been in my arsehole stage for nearly 46 years, Marino. You know that. There's a lot of good value out there in the marketplace, collecting cars being a place where you could, if you wanted to, buy a motor car. But I've got a lot of the good value stuff has got a paddle gearbox from that era when paddle gearboxes were really shit.
Oh,
mm-hmm. And it kills me. So what I keep looking at 599s, it's almost like I forget what the gearbox is like. I look at a 599 and go, well, I look at that, 80 grand for one of those. Then I think, I don't like the gearbox. What do we do? Well, can't someone go to Graziano or go to somewhere and just say, right, let's do a kit for all the great cars and make them manuals?
Well, you can buy a 599 manual. The problem is they're not value, are they? And they're dreadful as well because the flywheels are so small on them that every time you lift off and press the clutch, the revs drop.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. Is it going to be part of the charm? You know, when you drive a 512 Boxer and the gearbox is kind of bulky and stuff, and Is the 599 the new sort of version of that where you've just got to lift?
It's a very, very good way of pointing it. Quite often, and I've relied on this with my personality, if you can offset shitness through charm, you can actually get somewhere in life. But it's failed for me personality-wise, and it fails in cars. You get in cars, like a CSL, M3 CSL, E46, you get in, And for the first 10 miles, you go, yes, really charming this. I remember, then you just think, I'd rather be in a normal M3 with a fucking manual gearbox. I can't find my way around it. I love the LFA. The LFA is one of the greatest motor vehicles ever made. What would that be like with a manual gearbox? Wow.
Chris,
I think, though, with the shifting, though, you're part of the shift, though. When you're like in an old car and there's a slow shift, you're part of that and you have to manage it. The problem is, when you're just pulling a lever, you expect instant gratification. You expect, come on, get in there.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, I think, so.
I was selling the 599s and 430s when they were new, and you could not sell a manual 599, a manual 612, a manual 430. You know, at the time they allocated them separately. So you either had an allocation for an F1 or a manual. You couldn't decide which gearbox you had. So there were very few manuals for sale. But if you had a used one on the fork or a red 430 manual, you just could not sell that thing. And today there's probably, you know, there'll be 40% more expensive a used manual than an F1.
Yeah. Well, you guys don't know the pain of doing Sebring 12 hours in a 360 with the paddle shift on it. And I mean streetcar paddle shift, pre-Challenge Stradale. That is pain.
What are you doing? Are you counting five Mississippi between each gear change? One, two, three, four. And
you just keep pulling it till something happens as many times as you can. And then they take out a bit. This actuator went wrong and they pulled it out. It's got a Peugeot badge on it. You're like, ah.
But there's a whole part of our motoring history that I know that you two will be into as much as I am, as that era between 97, 98 to about, you know, to when the DCTs came in. These cars are going to fall off the radar because I think the transmissions are so shite that you can't find any charm in them. I mean, you drive, you know, a 3.5, if I said to you, you can either have a 3.55 with an F1 gearbox or no 3.55, you just have no 3.55, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Don't you get that on collecting cars? You click through it and you go, oh, yeah, look at that. It's beautiful. It's grey. Oh, I love the blue leather. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
We get that all the time. I walk through Bristol and I'll see an M3 E46 and you always have that little peek through the window and you're like, oh, shit. Oh, no. It's got that stubby chrome bastard in it. Oh, no.
But there's going to be a place that those cars are going to have a place. They're going to be at the bottom of the food chain. Absolutely. But I think they're going to be more affordable. And it'll provide an entry point. You want a V12. It's going to be the 412 of our generation.
I want a 412. We should buy a 412 and do a 3-up, 4-up road trip in a 412. Definitely.
Oh, amen. Yes.
Old style, we can buy beer and jazz mags in a 412 across. we can go and deliver. Name one of your friends, McNish. I don't know him, but we could deliver adult magazines to him in a 412.
He'd love it. Yeah, can you imagine? Christopher, what are you in the back of?
Mulsanne. Geez, a honey. I'll let you give you a little guide into there. I'm in the back of a normal wheelbase Mulsanne with my dog. He's just having a sleep down there, and then that's Pip. The reason for that is I've just bought a flat, and it doesn't have any internet, and the phone doesn't work in there. My phone works on the top of the Atlas Mountains, but it doesn't work in the middle of Bristol. So I'm slightly struggling. So this is my current office. As kindly donated by the Bentley Press Office for a couple of weeks.
Sweet.
It's a very nice way of living, actually. And I did have a Mulsanne. I think Dario and I share an affliction there. We both itched the Mulsanne scratch. I loved mine. I really did. Did you just think it was too big and too plutocratic?
No, I loved it. I loved everything, but I'd kind of done it. I drove it. Marino and I jumped in it when it was new. We drove it to Anglesey for the Race of Remembrance. Drove it home. Did some... tour with some friends. We did tours of all the various, like Max did Page, we went to Joe McCarry, went to really cool...
Tuttle, don't forget Tuttle.
Went to Tuttle's, yeah, sorry, Richard. We went to these various different places with this thing and they all sat in the back and I drove. The wife and I got driven into to the Autosport Awards in it. which was great until we got to a woods restriction and my mate that was driving wasn't quite confident enough to take me through. He's used to driving an A8 round and he just didn't feel quite, so I had to get in and drive it through the woods restriction. But I loved it. I got it sideways on the getting onto the M40.
That was fun.
Which took some doing, yeah.
It all happens very slowly. It's such a long wheelbase. It just sort of, it tells you right. 5 minutes before it might go sideways. Then it happens and you go, oh, there we go. And off we go again.
And I'm not like you, Chris. I'm more like Marino in that my whole life has been making cars go around corners as cleanly as possible. So when I do try and do a skid, I tend to crash. So, you know, it's a bit of an affliction. You know, people do... What was I doing? And they're like, oh, can you RS500 for this TV show? Can you make it go a race car? Can you make it go sideways? No. Because every time I tried, the thing would hook up and spit the other way. And that turbo lag like a jet fighter.
I've only ever met of the people I've met that can drive at all, the ones that deliberately went sideways, I've met a few that made a good living. I've met a lot more that have made a much better living by making cars not go sideways. So you two are definitely in the correct camp when it comes to looking after yourselves.
Yeah, but you do it. You do it in a... You are not blowing smoke here. First of all, I just want to go back slightly. I always thought you'd end up living in a car, but not a Bentley. So... the thing for... You drive with such precision sideways. I love it. Like that video we did with the laugh and the 918.
We've got to talk about that.
You're just so precise and it's just poetry in motion. And I covet it. I would love to be able to do that. Because you can do the other stuff.
I'm not having it. You two have much superior skills to me. I'm a journeyman, but I have a good laugh. Let's come back to that.
Let's get back to Tuttle. He just throws the car at the scenery and works out how not to die.
He is an extraordinary human being. His level of car control and the confidence to sort a problem out. I mean, one day we'll get him back on the podcast and talk about the time when we had a few beers with my students and I got angry and punched a window and it had that reinforced metal in it and it popped. It popped the main artery down my arm and I was, let's just say, it was coming out quite quickly. And Tuttle decided he was the only person to get me up to the John Radcliffe Hospital as quickly as possible with claret literally flying out like Spider-Man. And Richard's driving, as just before I passed out in the back of his red Golf, I remember thinking, if we don't die on the way there, I stand a chance of getting there in time. He's driving on the way there. It was utterly outrageous. I remember him going round Maudlin roundabout the wrong way. Oh, but yeah, he can properly pedal. But, Let's come back.
918. Yeah.
So this is an interesting time in my life. Dario, I think, is probably... So in 2015, Dario, have you had your big shunt then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was... Yeah.
Yeah. So you're probably just relaxing and enjoying your retirement. And I'm all over the place. I've just... Work's not happening. And I'm thinking I'm going to go and sell cars in Bristol. It's all shite. And the internet's not working for me. And I think Marino's probably, you know, you're pretty quiet as well. There's bits and bobs going on. I don't know. Who were you racing for at that point? Was that about to become Ford then?
That was... Well, I went from doing the video with you to Car of the Year in Scotland with Evo straight to America to drive the Ford GT.
That was it. That's it. I'm just trying to get some context. Remember, because lots of things have happened since. And I just thought, you either get a load of people to do this with you that, you know, you either shoot for the stars and you try and get the conventional biggest racing driver star names in the world. Do you try and get Sebastian Vettel? Do you try and get Jenson Button? Because, there's a feeling this could be quite a big film because there was a pregnancy and people wanted to see these three cars together. First of all, to be totally transparent about how I got the cars, I'm not sure if I ever told you this, Marina. I went onto the stand at Geneva Motor Show. Stefano Lai, the wonderful Stefano Lai, who was the Ferrari communications director at that point. Only Ferrari who could have a guy whose surname, when translated to English, is Lies. So the PR manager for Ferrari then was called Stephen Lies. He was an absolute legend. But I loved Stefano, and I know he's retired now, but if he ever heard this, I wanted to know how much. I thought he was a great character. I walk onto the stand and I go, "Can I have a LaFerrari to put against a P1 and a 918?" And he went, and I said it. so sarcastically because I had no footing. I didn't have a TV show or anything to leave her with. I had a bit of an internet presence. And he went, do you know what? Yeah. And I went, are you taking the piss? And he went, no. And what had happened was it was the week after Jeremy had said that on Top Gear, it was one of the last episodes that they did Top Gear, he'd made some reference about the fact that Ferrari wouldn't turn up with a LaFerrari because they were scared of putting it against the P1 and the 918. They'd slightly ridiculed Ferrari in their studio environment. And Ferrari was so pissed off with that they said, we'll give you the car just so we don't give it to him. And I went, you taking the piss? And looking back, it probably slightly altered all of our lives, didn't it? It was a mega thing to do. It just came about because Jeremy had been impish with them. Obviously, they ended up getting the cars for their Grand Tour launch thing, which was shot like a week after we'd been there. But it was special, wasn't it? And I think what I hope people got feeling was that we had lots of fun doing it. I didn't want the Vettels and I didn't want the superstars. I wanted some people there that I could have fun with. So
that's the impression I got.
Yeah, good fun. You know, it was just, it was like a bunch of mates, and we had Neil O and we had Mavro, who's a friend from America who came over and shot, and we had Jamie Lippman doing the stills. Everyone there was a friend, but I needed a combination of people that could properly pedal and could have a laugh. And Marino and Tiff, it's an unlikely combination, and it's maybe we'll never end up on screen together again. It'd be a shame if we didn't, but it worked. Brilliant. It really worked. And
talking of freakish car control, Tiff's unbelievable. But making that was joy. But I think as well, at the time, you were like, you know, up to your neck. This had to work. It had to happen. It had to work the same way. And while it was a lot of fun, the stress, I mean, I've seen you stress before, but I've never seen you stress like that. And it's a very special thing. People talk to me more about that when I meet them than anything else. It's always brought up at least a couple of times a week. It's
interesting.
It's a very special thing.
We were lucky to do it. And maybe, Dario, we could come to you at some point when we do Valkyrie versus T50 versus Mercedes, whatever they're going to call it. And we can make you a part of the next one. We could have the two Franchitti brothers and me and something else. That'd be quite good, wouldn't it?
That'd be fun, wouldn't it? That's got to be a combination.
A week in Portimao playing golf. We'd have to have Tiff down there just doing weights and measures because he'd have to serve the drinks for himself, basically, because the consumption rate of that man needs to be seen to be believed. But no, they were happy times. And I like that we all take gambles, don't we? I'm sure that you've both done things where you knew that it was probably reckless to do it, but the upside was potentially so great that you had to take the risk. I think racing drivers probably do that more than any other individual that I know. They take risks because they're not scared of consequences, or because they're so hungry to get to a place that they're not willing to even consider failure. They just do it.
If I look back at some of the stuff I did, absolutely, I go, what was I thinking? Wow, that was ballsy. And then I look now and I'm a completely different person and I'm very, very risk averse. But back then, yeah, crack on.
What was we'll have to wrap this up fairly soon, but because you raced in an era where there was a lot of power floating around. Did you ever drive a racing car that was too fast? Because it's often said that racing drivers can never have too much power, but do you adhere to that or not?
A difficult question. From a pure competition standpoint, there was never enough power. I drove a car that had a thing called a Hanford device on the back, which was designed to slow it down, like a parachute, a reverse wing, the big bit hanging down to slow the car down. Yet it would still, especially in the tow, it would pull 250 something miles an hour. Gilles Deferrin did a lap at California Speedway at average speed 242, I think, was the average.
Average.
That was the average. And those were they too fast? They caught the imagination, and bloody hell, they were scary to drive. And you know, I lost one of my best pals, Greg Moore, in that era. They were just so unforgiving. I think that's the thing, and that was part of the challenge of it. And both Marino and I. And I don't know, Monk, have you driven the 917-30?
I've had a go in a 917-10, not a 30. So I've probably driven 1,000 horsepower, not 1,300.
Yeah. So both Marino and I drove that up the hill at Goodwood. And I drove it on the Saturday, Marino drove it on the Sunday. And I said something like, oh, poof. Yeah, it's like quick, but I didn't actually get to full throttle. And Marino looked at me and went, why not? Yeah, Marino, yeah. But he'd had the bravery pills that weekend because he took our mum up the hill in the Noble and was clocked going by the house at
140.
140 by the house. What are you thinking?
It was great. I thought, mum's been really game here. She didn't say a thing the whole way up. And our mum likes a wee moan. She didn't say a thing the whole way up. And I get across the line and back off and look over and all I hear is, I breathe the whole way up there. Before we wrap up, how is your GT3? Your touring?
It's quite well used now. It's done 50, it's coming up on 60,000 kilometres, I think. And it's done, and Pip and I live in it the whole time. So he's made a few choice adjustments to seat runners, seats, that kind of thing. So it's, and I don't need another car. It's very strange, isn't it? I think we're all really lucky that we got access to some amazing cars. But there are certain vehicles that just fit with your life and the way that your brain works and what you want in a car. I can finish testing the most incredible street car, hypercar, even racing cars. And every time I get in my little touring, I just think this is the only car I ever want. I just love it. It goes very well. And it's a bit yellow, I know, but it's the only one I could get at the time. I know, it's the only one I could get at the time, but I think it'll stay with me forever. What about, I may order a 992 touring, I'm not sure.
They set the game up with a 992, in your view?
Say that again?
Are they going to step the game up with a 992, in your view?
Yeah, you know, I've got to be careful.
He always does, doesn't he?
I've already got myself in trouble with Porsche a bit, haven't I, with this GT3 business? But they've never made a car that was worse than the one before. I'm aware of that. They've made cars that have got less character and have lost aspects, be they electric power steering and stuff like that. Hmm. But they've never made a car that's worse. I think they have. I think it's fair to say that engine's reached the end of its life now in terms of being developed much further. You might get another 10, 20 horsepower. But it's not. You're not going to get an exponential increase. You're not suddenly going to have a 600 horsepower normally aspirated GT3 anytime soon. That isn't going to happen.
As long as you remember that better is not necessarily fast. You know, it's not. You don't have to be. As you say, character is the word, and that's, you know, that's
AP gets that, I think.
Yeah, he does.
I think if anybody does, he gets it.
He totally gets it. And I totally agree. Now, before we leave, we have to just ask one question. And this is far more painful than to one of the Franchitti brothers. And I can only say it because I know I'm safely distanced in a double glazed Bentley, probably several hundred miles away. Which one of you owned and sold a 964 3.8 RS?
That's not me.
And he's left the room. And he's left the room. Oh, hey, no,
listen, he
for the benefit of everyone that can't see this, he's now showing us a model of it. Now, Dario, three-time Indy 500 winner, explain yourself.
Right. So I never thought I'd get to buy it. It was one of the three right-hand drive cars. It lived pretty much its whole life in Scotland. Jack Tordoff from JCT was the first owner, and then it went to Scotland. And I used to see all these things, and I kept asking the man that owned it, Neil.
The butcher that owned it.
Yeah, Neil's a butcher. Paid a lot of money for it in 1996 or something. I kept saying, Neil, sell me the car. Nope, never selling it. Neil, sell me the car. Nope. So then the white car came back from Australia, and it sold for quite a lot of money in London. And I was sitting at the Hotel de France, and I get this phone call. I think I'm going to sell that car. But anyway, bought the car, sent it to Reading. They went right through it back to front. And it was perfect. I took the silencers off it because it needed to be louder. And it was absolutely perfect. The problem was it was too perfect. And every time I drove it, and it wasn't about the value of the car. because I've owned cars, more expensive cars, whatever, but it wasn't about that. It was about if it was original. And if I did, and if I got stone chips or any of that stuff, it was one of those three cars, and it just felt so special that, you know, I wasn't enjoying it. I wasn't enjoying taking it out because of that. And I sent it down to Lee Maxted Page, who sold it within a day. And the man who bought it was the same as me. He drove it and was like, "Oof, it's too nice to drive." And it's been for sale for a while. But I mean, I've got a model of it in my office. What does that tell you about it? Such a special, special car. What can I tell you?
It's better to have loved and lost in many respects. And I totally sympathize with this idea of something being too good to use. When something's too good to use, particularly as a motor car, it starts to lose its purpose, I think. As I only ever owned one car in my life that was, I was worried about the value of it, and I started worrying about stone chips and stuff like that.
Yeah. What would that be, a 993 GT2?
For the benefit of people that are not seeing this now, I'm now giving the V's to the Franchitti brothers. I had the same. Like, it was just a car that I start, for the first time, I don't care about the way things are presented. You might have realised that. And I don't care about using stuff at all and getting stone chips and wrecking tires and what have you. But for the first time ever, I remember getting, a lorry was coming towards me. And as I came towards the lorry, I winced and thought, "Oh God, what if it kicks up a stone?" At that point, I went back and I think, "Oh, this is drawing behavior out of me that isn't me. Therefore I can't drive it anymore."
Yeah. I think that's the only car I've had that does that. The F40 I'm precious about. I've owned it for nearly 22 years. I've owned the same car. But most of the stuff I'm not that precious about. The Daytona Spyder I'll take out and blat around, but this car just brought something out. And what a thing though, especially with the straight pipes on it. It sounded quite lovely.
Right, guys, I think we're going to have to wrap it there. To Marino and Dario, thank you so much for giving us a bit of time, and a very, very happy Christmas to you both. I hope that you settle down with your loved ones and enjoy whatever you can do in within these restrictions. It's been a bizarre year. Edward, I know you've been a little bit quiet up there, letting us just natter and talk shit, but Collecting Cars has had a frankly phenomenal year. You know, it started out as something that people had heard of but didn't really know what it was about, and now has sold thousands of cars this year and is a market leader. You know, it is turning over more than any other auction house in the UK at the moment. And you should be very proud, Edward. And I hope you can have a glass of mulled wine and maybe take your foot off throttle for about 5 minutes over Christmas, because you are flat out the whole time. From Collecting Cars HQ to all of you out there, have a great Christmas. Enjoy your motor vehicles. Be safe. Don't do anything reckless. And we will hear from you, or see you, or you'll hear from us in the new year. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Collecting Cars, the safe, smart and simple way to buy and sell collectible cars. An online auction platform for the UK and Europe. Follow us on Instagram at Collecting Cars and also collectingcars.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free.
warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.